Okay, good afternoon, folks. Welcome to this, our fourth episode of Journey into Excellence. Fifth. We've made five episodes, gangs. Our expert panel is Marty Haysacker, Brian P. Higley, and Jack Malcolm. And in previous shows, we've discussed how common thinking errors or logical fallacies often serve as barriers to clear thinking and stability, and how reducing these errors can promote excellence across a variety of domains. In this episode, we go deeper into our journey into excellence by focusing on how clear thinking can lead to a life of the equality slash civility wheel, and how poor thinking can result in a life of the power and control abuse wheel. This is going to be a good show, folks. As usual, our panelists will provide listeners with specific suggestions for how to parent, educate, and lead slash manage in ways that promote success and satisfaction, and that continue to clarify the critical role of clear thinking and civility in being helpful to ourselves and others. I'm your host, Vernon Bohr, and with that, Brian, why don't you start us off, as usual, because you really kicked off these wheels for the people. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so these two wheels are wheels I actually came across in my journey into excellence, so to speak, into the family system. And just to remind our listeners, we're journeying into excellence into three major systems: family system, education system, and leadership slash management system. I came across this in some work that I did with Dr. Paul Wheeler in a batterer's intervention program, folks that were mostly court-ordered to come and learn from Dr. Wheeler, and he allowed me to co-facilitate with him for a year and a half on how to treat people that you're supposed to love in ways that are helpful to themselves and others rather than harmful. And ever since I came across these wheels, this was over, I guess it's over 20 years now, I started to notice that they seem to apply across all three systems, so not just in terms of the family, but also helpful in terms of education and leadership. And so I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into these wheels. We've mentioned them a bit in past podcasts, but what I thought I would do, if it's all right with the rest of the group, is go through each quote-unquote spoke of the wheel, which contains an idea that's related to either equality and civility or power, control, and abuse, put them out there, and then maybe ask Marty to just start talking about these concepts from the family systems perspective. And then I really liked what we did last time. Instead of just waiting for Marty to be done and then me to be done and Jack to be done, I just thought if anything pops up in anyone's mind as Marty's talking, whether it be in the education system or the leadership system or the family system, we would just kind of free flow. Does that sound okay to you all?
Yep.
Perfect.
I'm good.
Good. So the first idea comes from the equality slash civility wheel, and these are ideas that I think and others have thought over the decades are associated with being civil, and as you all know, we're about clear thinking and civility on this podcast. The first idea from the equality civility wheel is negotiation and fairness. So if you're behaving in a way that's aligned with the civility wheel here, you're looking to find mutually satisfying resolutions to conflicts. You're looking to negotiate in what Stephen Covey would call a win-win way rather than a win-lose way. So that's the idea on the equality slash civility wheel. The mirror image of that comes from the power and control slash abuse wheel, and that is use of coercion and threats. So instead of trying to negotiate fairly with people and be a win-win person, you try to threaten the other person or persons in order to get what you want. So it's what Covey would call sort of a win-lose in an abusive way. So that's the introduction to two concepts, one from the equality civility wheel and one from the power and control abuse wheel. And with that, I'll throw it on over to Marty to see if he has any thoughts on how those play out in healthy families versus harmful families.
And before Marty, before you jump in here, can I just throw something out here that just really struck me? Because we live in a technological age, and families deal with that as well. And we've heard a lot about bullying and stuff. So I invite our listening audience, as they listen to us in terms of our basic context and overview, to think about ways this might apply in a digital world and our interactions one with another. On the internet, Facebook, whatever, because we have a lot of interaction going on these days, just as we're interacting today on this this podcast, and I think it's easy to forget that.
Well, good point. I can tell you, Vern, in my case, it's very close to home because one of my children was internet bullied when he was in middle school, early high school time period, to the point where I was afraid for his life. I thought he was going to actually run out of coping skills and maybe try to harm himself. It was brutal, and I was utterly powerless to do anything about it. And what was interesting is you typically think of boys being bullied by other boys. It turns out that the cyber bullies against him were young girls in our neighborhood, his same age. So, and it was posting unkind things about him and drawings that made him look ugly and all that kind of stuff. But he got through it. But I can tell you, in my family, this notion is not distant. It's very, very close because it really affected us all. And he got through it, but it was a very, very challenging time. Returning back to the –
and I'll jump in real quick, Marty, and I think you already know this, but Jonathan Haidt and others have been researching those kinds of experiences, and they've come to some pretty scary conclusions that it might be increasing depression and suicide rates. So I'm really glad that we're delving into this area.
Yeah, actually, one of my one of our colleagues, Dr. Dorothy Espelage, who for several years was here at Florida, but who's now relocating to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, is one of the foremost authorities on school-based bullying. But it is, of course, school-based bullying echoes out into the digital world. And she actually was the first person to say to me, I was sort of saying, you know, my son is kind of despondent, and you know, and she said, take it extremely seriously. Do what you need to do to protect him. Even if he has to move out of the community, do it. Because even at that time, which is now many years ago, she had seen this big uptick in suicide and other harmful behaviors that were triggered by this. I mean, the truth is social interactions are very powerful, which returns us back to the civility wheel and the equality civility wheel and the power and control or incivility wheel. So the point is, all the stuff we're talking about, not all, but the vast majority of the things we're talking about are social behaviors. I mean, in the most incivil cases, people get hit or hurt or murdered or whatever, but many, many incivil power and control behaviors occur in regular social life, and likewise, many civil and equal behaviors, they just sort of pass unnoticed because they're part of regular social commerce. But there's a huge difference in families when families engage in equality, civility versus when they engage in power, control, incivility. So, and also, it isn't that one family does one and another family does another. There are some families that are very fraught, and there are norms that allow people to be incivil and to engage in power and control behavior. And there are families that really discourage that and strongly support and encourage equality or civility. But every family does both. And so I think we want to be careful not to sort of you know, dust our hands off and go, no, that's not our family. Once you really tune into what the differences are between civility and incivility, you can see subtle incivilities in places you hadn't seen them before in your family. So returning to this, negotiation versus coercion. Coercion, there's many, many forms of this. That parental elevated voice, get in the car. That is coercive. It implies that if you don't get in a car, something really bad is going to happen. Or do it because I'm the father or the mother of this house. That's why. That's power and control. Now, one of the issues that sometimes comes up when I bring up these kind of examples of, well, wait a minute, aren't the parents the leaders and the authorities of the family? Yes, they are. But the truth is, like any other kind of leader, they can engage in negotiation or they can and civil engagement about following the rules and being held accountable, or they can do so in a coercive, power-oriented, controlling way. So, for example, we know that the most effective form of parenting is called authoritative, not authoritarian, which is power and control, but authoritative. And authoritative parenting is parenting in which the parents retain the primary responsibility in the family and the primary authority in the family, but as they do so civilly, and they do so by receiving relevant and appropriate input from the children and helping the children understand what the reasoning is behind the decisions that the family is making. So authoritarian.
And Marty, can I jump in really quickly and just kind of piggyback on that point really quick? Do you mind if I jump in?
Not at all.
Okay. One of the things that I like to talk about, you spoke of parents saying, well, I'm the authority in the family. And one of the things that we've been doing throughout our podcast is connecting clear thinking with civility. And one of the thinking errors that we've talked about is appeal to authority. So in order to help parents who say, well, I'm the authority, to avoid the logical fallacy that can move to the abuse that you've been talking about or the incivility, is I ask them to maybe put aside the idea that I'm the authority and instead ask them if they want to become an expert at parenting, differentiating between somebody who is the authority because they have the power versus someone who has done their homework in terms of what is best for their children. And that, to me, is a parenting expert. So I thought I'd just throw that in as you were talking about that common, I think, often excuse to stay on the power and control wheel in families, and that is, well, I'm the authority.
Yep, I think that's right. The other thing is that if we are optimally parenting, what we're hoping to do is invite our children to have a deeper understanding of how the world works, of how relationships work, of how personal elements in life work. So the truth is, life presents our children with literally thousands of opportunities to learn how the world works. For example, if you want to remain successful in school, it isn't going to be likely to be achieved if you fail to do your homework or if you find reasons to not go to school. Those are just natural components in life. And so if you can step off of the authoritarianism, you got to get to school right now or Buster, you're going to be in big trouble, or you can't eat dinner till you get your homework done. Instead of those kind of authoritarian moves, which deprive the child of learning about how the world naturally works, you can shift over to the civil alternative where you're negotiating and helping the child understand what the operative principles are in any given situation if he or she does not already understand them.
And I think required to circle back to a quick point, Vernon, and then I'll pass it on over to you. I think that requires liberty from the appeal to authority logical fallacy. That parents have to liberate themselves from that so they can, instead of just repeating I'm the authority, they can instead say, I need to become a more expert at the kinds of things that I need to become expert at so that I can facilitate expertise in my children. Vern, do you have something you're gonna ask?
Can I just ask real quick, when you're talking about authority, Brian, are you talking about authority such as what comes with your position? Or are you talking about authority in a sense that I have superior knowledge and experience and therefore I know better what to do?
I think that that differentiating that is so important that I use different terms. I think about authority as a power and control thing where you just say, I have the power, so I'm the authority. I think about the second thing that you just said is expertise. I have expertise, and so if you listen to me, you'll get better outcomes in your life.
Okay, and that's why something that's been bugging me a little bit about what we're talking about is I'm not sure what – maybe I'm not seeing the word negotiation as you are, but if you're talking about negotiation versus coercion, it sounds like that's a binary choice and there's more than two choices. And I would put appeal to logic and reason as, or maybe even call it persuasion as a third choice there. because negotiation is kind of like giving, and in my mind, is giving and taking certain things so each side wins. Sometimes there doesn't need to be each side wins. Sometimes it goes back to what Marty said about giving them the reasons or helping them reason through why this might be the right course of action to take.
Yeah, I think that's what, even though the word negotiation is used oftentimes in the equality / stability wheel, I think that idea is more of what they're getting across. To me, sometimes I think about it as negotiating centered around reason rather than fallacy.
Okay.
I think that's a good point, and as you know, words have their limitations, so we've got to keep talking about them. But I think that's the general idea, the differentiation between the equality civility wheel and the incivility power control wheel. I think it's in the area of what you're talking about.
Okay, so it's not just reading the art of the deal and now you got it.
No. I'm sorry, I was just
tossing that in just to see how you guys would react.
Oh, I think this is a really important point, and I want to dig deep into it because I think there's a lot of confusion about this, and words have their limitations. So I think we've got to keep digging into this in order to be clear about the differences between acting on the two wheels. So I really appreciate it, Jack.
Okay.
So I had three thoughts about it, Jack. The first one is that when a child wants to engage in a behavior that I as a parent don't want them to engage in, usually they have a motive that has some sense of validity. I want to do what I want, or I want to taste this good food, or I don't want to be restricted, or I want to try this new thing. So when a negotiation occurs between a parent and a child, I think it's important to recognize, yes, you have a motive, and that motive is reasonable. It's got to be put in the context of other motives that might need to be more carefully. In other words, so I think you've got to negotiate that both the players in one of these parent-child conflicts have a motive that's worth recognizing. The second thing I wanted to say is part of what negotiation means is that we care enough about each other to negotiate our relationship with each other. The trouble with the power and control wheel is I basically say I couldn't care less about our relationship because I want to win. And what the equality or civility wheel says is I care about our relationship with enough that I want to negotiate with you so that at the end of it we still have a relationship.
Okay.
And then the third thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Martin. Yeah, third thing.
So the third thing I was going to say is I've parented two boys born 10 years apart, so I have a long scope of parenting, even though I don't have lots of children. But one of the things I've learned in that long scope of parenting is with my first son, I think I overregulated and overmanaged. And by saying that, what I mean is there were a number of things that, regardless of all the options that he was entertaining, nobody was going to die. No core principle of life was going to be sacrificed. In other words, it was relatively small potatoes in terms of any critical thing, and yet I still felt the need to sort of guide, direct, influence. And with my younger son, I got more sharp about that. I realized there are some things that he can flop around about, and it's going to have some adverse consequences that aren't going to be all that enduring and all that terrible. And so maybe I can step back and let him negotiate the world without my intervention on that. And so it's basically created two sort of different personalities in the two young men.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, to piggyback on that real quick, and I know Vern had something he wanted to say, so I want to get back to him.
Oh, sorry,
but,
Vern.
Not
a problem.
Completely fine. One of the things that you were talking, Marty, that came to mind is my current favorite definition of tyranny, which is the irrational use of force. And that's one of the reasons why I also call the power and control wheel the tyranny wheel, because it does not include rationality. So sometimes people will say, well, if you're going to negotiate with your kid, let's say your kid wants to stay up all night and you know the brain research on sleep, and so are you going to negotiate so that she can stay up all night and harm her brain? And my response is always no, but I'm going to give her rational answers for why we're going to do things not her way this time. And if I didn't have rational answers and was just forcing her to do certain things, then I would move over to the power control wheel. But because I have, in this case, research-based answers, even if I, quote unquote, win the debate, I'm not doing power and control or tyranny because I'm doing it from a place of rationality, even if she can't see it at this point.
I laughed about the sleep one because I never wanted to go to sleep as a little boy. This is a little anecdotal story. And so my father says, okay, you want to stay up? And we sat there. And every time I'd start to nod, I was probably two, maybe three, he'd nudge me, wake up, wake up. You wanted to stay up. And I'd wake up, kind of wake up, and not. And I got to the point that as I went on in life, I actually got to the point I thought I was going to, if I didn't sleep, I was going to die, but not like a fear of dying, but it's however a child sees death. And when you were talking about talking to a child, Brian, there's three things I'll deal with, say real quickly. I think it's easy as an adult to forget how a child's mind is structured and analyzes things. That's one of the things I've come to in my later years of life. It's kind of like you tell a child to look both ways before they cross the street. In a child's mind, that can be, if they turn their head right and left, they've complied, not understanding that you're looking for something coming on. So a child can look both ways right in the street. But what I wanted to say is that earlier, so I just want to throw that in, is age is kind of like a continuum. And this is on Marty. So in a way, we're all either parents or children in a huge community and society. And I've gotten to the point where I tell young people these days that they don't need to be rude or nasty to old people, but they also don't necessarily need to give old people that don't show them a certain respect back. You know, that doesn't mean you need to be nasty or weird. Because I've found and Marty, you're still in the university system. You probably work a lot with a lot of young people. And I've always found throughout my life when I deal with people that are younger than me, if I show them respect, they're always open to listening and they show me respect back. And I think that's a really important thing to remember in this whole wheel of force and everything. And what Jack said, though, also got me thinking here, because I think there's a distinction at times. There are certain things, because Jack, you're in business, that are non-negotiable, but not necessarily from the standpoint of power or control. And the thing that comes to mind is that people give up certain rights to make decisions in certain situations, let's say like in a military SEAL team or in business in Jack, that by out of respect and the agreement you've entered into is if you're given an order in the field in the military as a SEAL team, you act and obey on that order because it's part of the team,
right?
Something that's necessary to the functioning. And I guess I could sum all this up in a saying I'm so fond of, and that is half-assed is still half-assed no matter which cheek you got left. And if you take these things we're talking about and make hard, fast rules out of them rather than allowing them to guide you in your fluid interactions and your dance with life, then you've disempowered yourself as well.
And that, Vern, that brings up something that I've heard a lot when I've done trainings on power and control and equality or civility wheel, that people often bring up the military, and sometimes they'll bring up parenting as well. You know, what are you saying? I shouldn't grab my kid if he starts running to the street. And I keep going back to what has become my mantra, and that is power control or tyranny or abuse is irrational use of force. So even in the military example, if you're operating even as a military leader on the equality wheel, you explain at some point that the reason why you jump when we say jump is because if you don't, then, for instance, people can die. So even in a military setting or in a certain parent setting when you're grabbing that two-year-old who's running into the road, you're not using your force irrationally. You have a solid, rational reason for why you're doing things.
Which means you're not trying to power and control them.
That's in terms of the domination of the wheels. Yes. Dominating for no reason. Sometimes, you know, if my two-year-old's running into the street, I have to dominate her, grab her. But I'm doing it for a very good reason. People on the power control wheel don't need good reasons. They dominate psychologically and physically, and you ask them, well, what's the science behind that, or what's the research behind that, or what's the philosophy behind that, and there very often isn't any. They just want to dominate.
Yeah, the other challenge with that is every time you engage in behavior with your children, you are role modeling behavior for them. And so one of the painful things about when I have used the power and control wheel on my children is some days, weeks, months, or years later, I see one of my children exhibit exactly the same behavior that I did, and which I'm now sorry I did, because they've learned it, and they think, okay, it's okay, Dad did it. And that has sometimes been a painful reckoning.
Yeah.
And I think I'll keep linking us back to the fallacies that I think lead to incivility. And I think that's a case for whether it's children or students or employees across the three systems that we're talking about. That's an argument for, as quickly as possible, them liberating themselves from the appeal to authority fallacy as well. Obviously, it's difficult for younger children to do that, but as they get older, they're able to do that. And they're able to say, just because my parent did it, my teacher did it, or my leader did it, doesn't make it okay if it's abuse or power and control.
Right. Although I will say, true confessions, I saw when I started parenting, I found myself automatically and mindlessly engaging in exactly some of the behaviors my dad did. Some of them were great behaviors. Some of them were really unfortunate parenting behaviors. So that stuff, I learned it, and it sat back in there until the moment I was parenting myself, you know, now many decades later, and there it was, boom. And some of them were great, and some of them were terrible.
One of the great gifts that Dr. Paul Wheeler gave me when he allowed me to be his co-facilitator at this Batters Intervention Program, this was when I was in my mid or late 20s before I became a parent, one of the great gifts of my life was to be able to look over this stuff and think it through before I became a parent. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so thrilled about this podcast, is because it gives our listeners the gift that I got. And especially the listeners that haven't become parents yet, is to really deeply reflect on these things before you have kids. So that's one of the real thrills that I have about this podcast, is imagining that I'm giving the gift that I got from Dr. Paul Wheeler so many years ago.
Yep.
Brian, what you just said, I think, is I really want to leave with our listening audience that I am fascinated by, is that we have a panel, listeners, of professionals here. And what one of the things to take away from this is, you listen to every one of them. They live lives just like you do, in spite of their expertise. And I think that's really, because often, you know, we this whole notion of appealing to authority sometimes, I think, leads us to a point where we stop seeing others that are professionals and authoritative as human beings as well, and I just want to share that with people as they listen to us, is you are listening to a panel of experts engaging the same kinds of questions that you engage in your interactions every day, and I think that's fascinating. I think that's very empowering.
Thank you.
That's yet another message is liberate yourself from appeals to authority so that you can pursue expertise. And I think that's important both for people who are seen as authorities and for people who are listening to authorities, because people who are seen as authorities, Jack, you actually wrote a little bit about this. We had some email exchanges about the authority person who sort of gets lazy because everyone's kind of essentially worshiping him. But if you get caught up in your own authority, then you can move away from becoming an expert as you just sort of get lazy and as everybody sort of bows to you. And then as you're listening to authorities, authorities can steer you wrong. And if all you're doing is worshiping an authority rather than listening for really good evidence, you can also get distracted from expertise. Jack, were you going to say something about that?
Yeah, well, you have to find the right balance, because if you're, let's say you're running a large enterprise, you have a lot of things that you need to get done. You have a lot of duties and you have a lot of responsibilities. So it's very tempting to say, well, as long as if I know what to do, if I just tell people what to do and I don't explain it to them, that is extremely efficient and a lot of things get done and I don't spend a lot of time. On the other hand, what am I giving up over the long run? I can get lazy. It's like I wrote in one of my blogs, which you know about, Brian, is it's kind of like not using a calculator anymore, or not driving a stick shift, or all the things that become easy for us, or that we drop by the wayside that used to be easy for us. When we need it, we're not going to be able to do them as well. So you've got to balance that. If you're running a large enterprise, or running, it doesn't have to be large, anything important, you have to balance and say, to what extent do I actually take the time to really think it through and explain to people why I'm doing this, even if it's going to take a little bit more time. And the good news is that over time, that should build up their expertise, their self-confidence, and their efficacy to go out and do the things that need to get done. So
Jack, I think about that as the difference between sort of cultivating followers versus fellow experts. And I think that can make all the difference in family and in education and in leadership.
Right. And I don't want to bore you if I've already – did I ever tell you the story about Creighton Abrams and the tank?
No.
No, but I want to hear it.
Okay, this is a everybody knows who Creighton. Well, let me explain, because some of our listeners may not. He was the chief of staff of the U.S. Army, and he was the commander in Vietnam for a couple of years. And during his tenure there, things started going much better. So he's a very, very smart guy, and the Abrams tank is named after him. Back in World War II, he was a battalion commander in Patton's Third Army, and during the Battle of the Bulge, Patton made the Third Army had to make a quick left turn to try to cut off the German flank and cut off that bulge. And they are racing over ice-covered roads through the mountains to try to cut this off. So time is absolutely of the essence. There are lives at stake. And Creighton Abrams comes across a big traffic jam. Everything stopped, and he wonders what's going on, and he sees that there was a tank that had slid into a ditch, and the driver was a young enlisted man who did not know how to get the tank out of the ditch. So Creighton Abrams says, here, let me show you how it's done. He says, move over and watch me. And he, I don't know what he did. I think he went forward, then went backward, and then gunned it at the right time, and then popped it right out of the ditch. And he says to the enlisted man, he says, okay, you see how it's done? And he says, yes, sir, I do. And he says, good. And he puts the tank back in the ditch and walks off.
Yeah.
And I use that as an example of people are teaching people and giving people power even under some of the most pressing conditions. That is long-term leadership.
And I would say that is somebody who wants to create more experts rather than simple followers.
Yep.
And it reminds me of, we're trying to connect as much as we can here to evidence over fallacy. So I'll sort of support that with a well-researched theory that I think probably everyone's heard of called self-efficacy theory.
Yep.
Albert Bandura found that that we're more likely to do things if we feel like doing those things will lead to desired outcomes, in this case, getting the tank out of the mud. And if we feel like we can do those activities well enough to get the outcomes, in this case, getting the tank out of the mud. And the difference between improving someone's self-efficacy is often the difference between you having to get all the tanks out of the mud yourself and having all of your employees or partners able to do that as well. So I think that's a great story that to me just immediately made me think of self-efficacy theory. So I thought maybe what I'd do is throw out another couple of concepts from the power and control wheel and the equality wheel. Would this be a good time to delve into our second grouping here?
Yes,
fine
we would.
With me. Did we get enough cover about education system and about organizations and businesses?
Well, I thought I could throw this out, and so we could talk about both of these concepts in any of those systems. But we can hold off and keep going on negotiation versus coercion across the three systems.
Yep.
I'm open to
if everybody
way.
Feels good, let's roll.
Yeah, Brian,
let me
suggest something.
Yeah,
Brian, is what do you think about maybe kind of giving a brief overview of everything we're going to talk about? Because it's real easy as we get into the specific topics to get going specifically without giving the listening audience an overview.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. If that's okay with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So the first idea that we talked about was negotiation and fairness, which is an equality or civility wheel concept. The opposite of that, the power control concept, is coercion and threats. The second item that I thought we'd talk about today is non-threatening behavior, and that's the equality civility wheel. The opposite of that on the power control wheel is intimidation. The third concept on the equality civility wheel is respect, and its opposite is emotional abuse on the power and control wheel. Then we have on the equality civility wheel trust and support, with its opposite being isolation on the power and control wheel. Then on the equality civility wheel, honesty and accountability, with the opposite of that being minimization, denial, blame, and distortion on the power and control wheel. Next item on the equality wheel, responsible. In this case, it says the power control wheel is often used in families, so in this case it's called responsible parenting, but I think about it as responsible leadership. And its opposite is using in the family system, it'd be using children, but across all the systems, it would be using the less powerful. Then we have on the equality wheel shared responsibility, and the power control wheel is economic abuse. And then finally, economic partnership on the equality and civility wheel. And on the power control wheel, it's abuse of privilege. So those are the eight concepts. Is that good enough, Vern, in terms of the big picture?
Oh, yeah. And for the listening audience, as we kind of kicked this around before we started episode 5 here, is now that we've got an overview, we're going to probably break this up into quarters, as I recall. And so
yep.
We're talking
and,
about the first two right now to put it in perspective.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that. That's great. So the first item was coercion and threats versus negotiation and fairness. And now what I thought I'd do is move to the second item, which would complete the quarter of the wheels that we're going to be doing today. And that is on the equality civility wheel. It's non-threatening behavior, talking and acting so that all parties feel safe and comfortable, able to express their feelings and thoughts with each other. And its opposite on the power control wheel is intimidation, so trying to instill fear by using threats, looks, gestures, destruction of property. If you're in the home, it can be abusing pets, wielding weapons, kitchen implements, those kinds of things. So, Marty, maybe I'll kick it back to you if you want to say anything about non-threatening behavior versus intimidation, and then we can free flow from what you start us with, if that's all right.
Sure. So I think all of us have an intuitive sense of what this is. Intimidation is when one person instills fear or something related to fear, anxiety, concern in the other person. Sometimes it happens so quickly and automatically, or that the person does it so frequently that the person doesn't even understand his or her intimidating impact. But let's start with the equality civility wheel, which is that when the essence of civility is that we engage people in ways that are very unlikely to threaten them in any way. That is basically the definition of civility. Being civil means engaging another person in a way that activates no threat in that person. And so how that plays itself out in a family is very simple things, like when there's a big person and a little person, have the big person talk at the same eye level as the little person. When there's a person with a little voice and a person with a big voice, make sure that the person with the big voice doesn't use that voice to overpower the person with the little voice, which, of course, normally plays out as children versus parents. But also it can occur within spouses. So I have a dear friend whose wife summarily left him and did so with a great deal of sort of ancillary hostility. And he was talking to me on the phone about this now many years ago. And he said, "Do you believe the nerve of her?" And I said, "Well, it doesn't sound like nerve to me. It sounds like she feels really, has felt really intimidated by you, and she was sick of it, and she wanted to sort of throw salt in the wound on the way out the door." And he said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, "Well, I don't know that it's true. I'm just saying when I try to backward engineer why she would do and say what she did or said on the way out the door, and I try to think of what would I feel like had that, what would I have to feel like to engage in those behaviors, I think I would have felt a long haul of intimidation that I'm now done with." And he said, "But I'm not an intimidating person." And I said, "Well, that's not really your call. The right thing might be to check in with her and see how she experiences you." And the interesting thing is he was bigger. He was taller. He weighed way more. He had a very sonorous, impressive voice. He had a very elevated title and position. And she didn't have those things. And so the truth is, just on the surface, he had a whole lot of naturally intimidating components. And the other thing is he is a very avid gun collector, and she isn't, and he had a store full of guns. And I said, "You know, just let me take a flyer at this. I know it sounds crazy, but I listed all this stuff out for him." And he said, "I had never thought of it that way." And I said, "This doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you a person who may need to check out whether you're not aware of some of your impact on your spouse." Long story short, he was not defensive about it. He reached out to her. She had the courage to be very, very forthright about her experience, and it turns out I was pretty much on the mark. And from there, he realized, "I don't want to be in a relationship. First of all, I don't want her to leave me, and second of all, there's no future in us having a relationship together with her feeling chronically intimidated." And so he set about the business of owning his impact, even though it wasn't his intention, and the two of them have built their relationship back together, and they're now thriving. But it was a case where she felt tremendously and repeatedly intimidated, and he literally had no awareness that this was his impact on her. And it was
Marty,
crazy to tell
him quick, and I'll jump in real quick and tell you that another evidence-based learning theory that came to my mind as you were talking was the person-centered approach from Carl Rogers. You all might know this, but he really emphasized three attitudes, and if you had these three attitudes, you'd be able to learn and change and grow in a equality and civility wheel-centered way. Genuineness was one of the attitudes. Unconditional positive regard was another one, and a third one was empathy. And as you were talking, Marty, I kept thinking about the concept of genuineness, which is oftentimes associated with being aware of yourself. You were talking about the person's size, voice, guns, all these things. And it sounds like that you did something that Carl Rogers would be proud of. You helped him to reflect and sort of get his awareness of himself to be congruent or to match the person that he actually is. And it led to some pretty major insights.
Yeah, I mean, I think really what it started with was I had this moment of thing. I remember this whole conversation occurred when I was off at a conference where I was making a presentation. I thought, "I don't have time for this. I'm getting my tie on." But he was a dear friend, and I took the time. But I had that moment where you're saying, how do I just sort of placate and put a Band-Aid on this, get my tie on, get my suit on, and get out of here, versus here's what I'm seeing. Let me be honest and genuine with you and take the risk. And I held my breath and thought, this could end up blowing up all over me. But I cared enough about him that I was genuine, and that my initial genuineness was, I think, what gave him the opportunity to really do great work.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was actually going to bring up the idea that you brought up about a lot of times you don't know your impact on others and you don't know if you're being intimidating. And
right.
I think that's I see that in business where the CEO says, oh, I have an open door. You can come to me with any complaints, any problems. You can speak up. And people are going, yeah, okay. Person who tried that, whatever happened to him? And the CEO may be 100% sincere in saying that and 100% genuine and 100% well-meaning and having positive regard for others and still not realize that people aren't going to necessarily do it. So two points there. One is like your friend never would have realized it if you hadn't told him. And I think some CEOs or anybody at a very high level position of authority can benefit from having either a coach or somebody, a neutral observer who's not afraid to tell them, hey, this is what I'm seeing and this is how you're coming across. Mm-hmm. In business, they also have 360 surveys where people get feedback from superiors, subordinates, peers, and so on. And it can be anonymous. So that's another way to deal with that. And then the other thing is that sometimes if you're at that level, you need to almost stage a show where somebody, I don't know whether you actually stage it this way, but you have somebody actually openly disagree with you and you get won over to their way of thinking in public.
That makes me think of something in the educational realm that I'll do, because in my role as an educator, I know that I'm in a position of power and authority as well. One of the things that I've done that's along those very lines is when people disagree with me in rational, reasonable ways, for instance, maybe they'll cite the textbook or they'll bring in an article. I will actually congratulate them and give the entire class points for that. So that's another sort of specific thing that you can do for people to show that you're not just tolerating rational disagreement, but you're actually embracing it, rewarding it, loving it. So I thought I'd just piggyback off of your recommendation there from something from the educational realm.
Yeah. Yeah. And one other point, too, is that we always need to take into account cultural considerations, because we're saying that we're making it easy for people to interact with us on an equal level and that they shouldn't be intimidated. But some cultures are going to have that power distance where the subordinate is always going to give what we may think of as undue respect to the superior.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make sure that what we're talking about here isn't just about us being in a Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic society, as they call the weird people.
Yep.
That you brought up that I think is really important, and then I'll defer to Marty really quickly, is the difference between fear and respect. And that might be something
that we need
to dive deeper into, because sometimes, whether it be a cultural thing or something in a different system, I'll hear leaders, I'll hear educators, I'll hear parents talk cross-culturally about practices that they think bring about respect, that when you actually analyze it from even like a nervous system approach, a fight or flight or freeze response, we might want to talk more about those responses. They're actually inducing fear rather than actual respect. So I thought I'd throw that out there, and if we want to play with it, we can. Marty, do you have something you were going to say?
What I was going to say is I think that Jack's point about understanding different cultures and different cultures' norms is an example of non-threatening behavior. Part of what can create threat is when somebody whose core values and social rules are rooted in one culture is feeling pressure to abandon those in the face of somebody who's rooted in a different culture. So I think Jack's call for us to be sensitive to the cultures of the people with whom we interact is an example of how you get to be non-threatening in your behavior to other people. Cultural ignorance produces threat because we will end up expecting people to behave in ways that are inconsistent with their core values. And I think this deference thing is a classic example. Americans are just not generally very deferent, but when we're working with people who were born and raised in a culture where deference is central to the culture, it's really threatening to them for us to demand that they engage in openness and disregard for social status that is part of American culture. And even American culture has more status control than we like to admit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it sure does.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and I'll bring it back again to Carl Rogers' learning theory, the person-centered approach. Now you're making me think of, we talked about his genuineness, now you're making me think of empathy, that especially if you have more power, it's really important to cultivate empathy. And we might want to play around with some of the research on what happens to people when they get more powerful in terms of their empathy. I've seen some research to indicate that as we get more powerful, we often become less excellent at empathy. And this is a journey into excellence. So power can actually be a barrier to being excellent in empathy. And according to Rogers' research, it's one of the three attitudes that is most helpful to ourselves and others. So we might want to play around with that too.
True.
Yeah, I was just thinking here, is something that seems very central to all this is there, you've all heard the saying, walk a mile in my shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that. And I find it intriguing in my life. I think that it's a real easy tendency, and it's been central to everything that I've heard said here, in my opinion, is it's easy to think that others see us the way we see ourselves. And you see this a lot. I see people a lot say, I don't care what they think about me. Mm. And I've come to the point of thinking that the universe is kind of willing to tell you how it thinks about you. And if it's inconsistent with the way you see yourself, you don't need to listen to it. But in Marty's example, his friend's wife saw him very differently than his friend saw him. And I think it's very easy to go through life being unaware of the fact that others don't see us as we see ourselves. And there's always an opportunity for us to be available and open up in a way so that others out there feel free and not threatened to express how they see us, and as such, be more effective in the world. I just throw that out. I think that for me, that's become very important in my life.
And Vern, that brings me to part of what the podcast is about is giving people practical solutions to some of these barriers. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about the importance of having people of equal status. Jack kind of alluded to this earlier, whether it be a coach or a fellow CEO or a person who's as big as you are, if it's a sort of a physical power thing that you're used to put you in check and to value being put in check by someone who's as big as you are, as powerful as you are, or well-connected as you are, and to understand that being put in check from time to time is actually helpful to yourself and can be helpful to others as well. So we might want to talk a little bit about how people can seek out people who can put them in check. One of the reasons why I love this podcast is that I feel like everyone on the podcast is of equal status and at least from it seems to me is fine sort of challenging each other when they feel like it needs to be challenged. And because I know the research on what power control can do to you if you don't check it, I seek these kinds of things out. So that might be something else that we can talk a little bit more about.
I also had another practical thing that you reminded me of, and this came from a guy that I know named Brian Higley. What often happens in the face of criticism, especially if you perceive yourself as being higher status than the person who's doing the criticizing, or even equal status, is that we respond with some kind of defensiveness that often comes across as intimidation. And the practical thing that Brian taught me many years ago, and it's something that when I feel sort of offended and I want to go to that intimidating place, who do you think you are to do that? I remember this clearly, and it is the notion, it's a very simple notion, and it is this: lean into criticism. Lean into it. In other words, instead of trying to rebuff the criticism or deny it or scare it away or crush it, what Brian invites us to do, and I have found this to be incredibly useful, is embrace it and just be a student of the criticism. Make sure you understand the criticism as much as you can. Appreciate the courage of the person who's offering the criticism. Do not try to impugn negative motives to the person who's providing the criticism. Lean into it. Try it on and assume for at least a moment or two that it's really an accurate criticism. And then what that does is that strengthens the relationship between you and the person who's providing the criticism. It also gives you an opportunity to really understand what the criticism is. Most of the time I'm so intimidated that I shut it off before I truly understand it and am able to process it. And then the final thing it does is it allows me, it invites me not to become nothing more than whatever the criticism is or whatever my rebuttal of it is. I am me. This is a criticism of things I've done or said. We're not identical, the criticism and me. We're separate. I get a chance to evaluate the degree to which it's true and not. Anyway, leaning in has given me a lot of benefits in my life. And so one of the very practical examples of a way to avoid engaging in intimidation, which is what is a very typical response by somebody who feels equal or high status in the face of somebody criticizing or perceiving, or we perceive them to criticize, is lean into the criticism instead of being intimidating.
You know, Marty,
Marty, that,
I like that
brings me back to the negotiation and fairness idea on the equality civility wheel. So if someone gives you a criticism, instead of coercing or threatening them, you see it as a negotiation. So you don't like X about me, I like X about me. So let's talk about X and figure out how we can both deal with X. Vern, go ahead.
You know, I was thinking about that as I was listening to you, Marty, and I was thinking also as I wind up many times thinking, that's interesting that you'd see that in me or see me that way as a way of leaning into it, because I never saw that before. You know, that's intriguing. Like, thank you. I never – I don't know where you come – I have to look at that. I don't know where – you know, I had never seen that before. And as a possible technique, because as I say, if someone tells you they see, for me, I found that if someone tells me they see me some way, I'm always looking at the gap between the way I see myself and the way someone else tells me they see me. And I'm always trying to close that to the extent that I want them to see me. By the way, con men know this. You know, a con man that doesn't look like a con man that looks like a con man is not very successful. A con man looks like what he wants you to see. And I see people my age, I just don't understand how he built me. He looks like such a nice, honest young man. Of course. He looks like he's from.
He's good.
He projected how he wanted to be seen by you. And so I think that the world gives us a lot of feedback that's very valuable. Yep. Sometimes we don't get to hear it.
I really like that phrase, and I'm going to remember that. I'm writing it down. Lean into criticism. I love that. I just wanted to throw something in, a quote from Epictetus. If you read any Stoic philosophy, he says that when somebody criticizes you, say, if that's the worst you can say about me, you must not know me very well.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I had a couple of thoughts. I'll just kind of rattle them off and see if they resonate with anything, with anybody. The third attitude of Rogers came to my mind. It's funny how these comments are bringing up all three of the Rogerian attitudes, but the third one is positive regard. And it sounds like in many ways people, whether it's through the use of humor or gratitude or whatever, it sounds like we're talking a little bit about, instead of disregarding somebody who has some challenging feedback, that you try to hold that person in high regard and either think it through or make a joke, that sort of a thing. The second thing, positive regard
also ties back to what we've talked about before, the fundamental attribution. Are they telling you because they're being hostile to you, or are they telling you because they're actually trying to help you?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And most of us react, you know, by default, we tend to see the worst side of it, or the worst explanation for why they're telling
us. Yeah, and that leads, Jack, I think that's 100% right. And that leads me to another thing that I think maps on to the non-threatening behavior spoke of the equality civility wheel. A lot of times people think about non-threatening behavior just in terms of how they interact with other people. But I think so much of this begins with how we interact with ourselves. And so someone will have a criticism that says, well, I think you're this or that. And instead of being non-threatening to the self, you threaten yourself. So, oh my gosh, I must be an awful person. I must be very stupid. So this self-talk that gets triggered by criticism often is the seed of threatening behavior to other people. If you talk yourself into being threatened because someone sees you a certain way, it's more likely that you'll project that threat out onto other people. As opposed to non-threatening behavior, if someone says, well, I don't like this or that, you can say, well, to yourself, don't threaten yourself. So instead of, oh, I'm stupid, you can say things like, well, nobody's perfect, or you can make a joke of it, Jack, like what you talked about. But I think taking the edge off by not threatening yourself when you hear criticism is the first step to not being threatening to the person who is providing the criticism.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I've got I have a little post-it right above my right where I can see it next to my computer, and I've had it there for over a decade, and it has two words on it: nothing's personal.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's personal. And the reason I have it there is because of just what Brian said. I was taking people's feedback to me, and I was using it to activate the internal critic in my own head, in a sense, giving those remarks that other people made without any context or background tremendous power to activate my own self-criticism. And so when I stumbled upon this idea of nothing's personal, it allowed me to have a little bit of a buffer between what people say to me and whether I do or don't activate my internal critic. And so it has made me paradoxically have much more embrace of people's feedback. And I think people actually, even though it sounds like maybe I would disengage with them, I think people would argue I'm actually more engaged with them because I don't take everything people say to me as brutally personal.
Marty, you were reading my mind because I had a note here. And what it says, it's actually a difference between Eastern and Western philosophy, maybe. It seems to me a lot of Western philosophies is either or, you know, and a lot of Eastern philosophy tends to be more and. And what I wrote down is take nothing personally and at the same time take everything personally. It's directed at you.
Neat.
But not it's a yin-yang kind of thing. In terms of I take it all personally and none of it personally. It's kind of like the reactive side that Jack was talking about. That's the side that we react to the everything personal like that, but it's not personal in that sense, if that makes sense to anyone. And then the other thing is, Brian, for those of you listening to us, is very frequently we'll have conversations before the show starts. And Brian wanted me to not forget something. And what that was is prior to the show starting, I was talking about how we live in a world where what we know is what we know within the peripheral of our senses. But everything else comes in from the outside, whether it be through the computer, the internet. And I'll let Brian take it from there, because you and I act as if much of the second, third, fourth source information we know directly.
Yeah, so,
and it causes us to react. And you didn't want me to forget that, Brian. I wanted to throw it out there and throw it back to you.
Well, I think there's so many different ways to go with this, but this is the way I'll do it and see if it resonates. One of the ways that I think about the power and control, the lack of civility wheel, the abuse wheel, is the wheel of irrational certitude. And then I think about the equality and civility wheel as the wheel of humility. Because so much of what happens, I think, on the power control wheel is often rooted in people who think that, or in an attitude of, I know something is for certain to be true, and you don't know it. So I'm one up on you because I'm certain about X, and you are uncertain. So you need to listen to me, you need to follow me, you need to do what I say. Most of the time when I investigate, we've been talking a little philosophy, and I think Socrates was famous for doing this. When people would make certain statements, he would engage in the Socratic method. And one of the reasons why people got so mad at him reportedly was through Socratic method, he often found, maybe always, found that people who made some kind of statement of certitude, that statement was based on fallacy. That they didn't actually know anything, but they thought they knew everything. I think what's one of the helpful attitudes that keeps people, including myself, on the equality civility wheel is a rational humility, where even if you have a lot of information, you recognize you'll never have it all, so you can't play the one-up card quite as easily when you're rationally humble. This was something that Carl Rogers spoke a lot about and wrote a lot about in relation to the positive regard aspects of things. That if you can stay rationally humble, it's much easier to regard other people pretty highly, whereas if you're irrationally certain, then it's really easy to disregard people, and often that disregard is based on fallacy.
Jack, did you
all talk
about
at once?
No, I don't have anything to throw in on that one.
What I was going to say on that one is one of the blessings of being a scientist, and I'm a behavioral scientist, is my nose is rubbed into the reality of my not knowing on an almost daily basis. So we will develop studies, read widely, have hypotheses that we're really thinking are pretty much true. And then we collect data to validate the hypothesis. And lo and behold, at least 50% of the time in the 35 years I've been doing this, the evidence does not support this prediction I so confidently held. And so,
right.
And so it's just a daily, literally almost at least a weekly reminder. I'm always analyzing data and so forth, but it's a nearly weekly reminder of that I know a lot of stuff that ain't so. And just that process of having that's been one of the greatest benefits of having a career in science is realizing, you know, I'm pretty smart and I've read a lot and I've worked really hard and I still make wrong predictions all the time. And so what that means is I simply have to remain constantly open to the fact that I am not necessarily right.
Marty,
it's a blessing.
I think that that's a great attitude to have. And especially in psychology, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but I'm sure you've seen some of the recent speculation in the writing about how so many studies that we've depended on have been irreproducible or have
the replication crisis led by Dr. Brian Nosek. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes.
And there's all kinds of things that we're finding that even and it's not just psychology and medicine, social sciences.
Right.
There's so much going on where people are finding that studies they relied on for decades can't be reproduced today or can't be replicated.
Yeah, we've
and
actually
Jack, that brings
funny
to
that
mind something
about.
From the educational realm. One of the things that I try to drive home in terms of philosophy of science in students, a lot of times students will come into science classes believing that science gets you to truth. And so once we find something, then we have the truth. So one of the things I work really hard to get them to unlearn is that and to learn the actual philosophy of science, which is the nature of knowledge is that, at least for human beings with our limitations, is that it's constantly flowing and changing. So once you become an actual scientist who understands the history, the methods, and the philosophy of science, you no longer depend on any study. You depend on the scientific method, and the scientific method is grounded in a rational humility because you know that anything that we believe to be true can be shown to be not so true at any moment, anywhere in the world.
Yep.
Yeah, and going back to Jack's, I think of Jack as the best read psychologist who's not a psychologist I've ever met. But back to Jack's point about the replication project, we actually in the last 10 years I've learned some critically important things about behavioral science because of that that I didn't know before. And for years I would run studies where each cell in a complex study would have maybe 20 or 30 participants in it. And when I got an effect that was statistically significant but not necessarily of huge magnitude, I celebrated it. And one of the things that the replication project has shown us is that the studies that were least likely to be replicated later in an independent lab had these two things in common. The sample sizes were not very big. They were those, you know, small sizes like the ones I used to do. And they were small effect sizes or medium effect sizes. The studies that have replicated are ones where many participants were run through and the effects were big. And so we've learned even now, I mean, just in the last 10 years, this is an eye-opening truth that has really guided my science moving forward.
I have a question
and
for Brian.
And it's one of the things that I'm glad – Vern, can I just say this really quick, and then I'll toss it over to you. Yet another reason why I'm really happy about this podcast is that I do want to, as much as we can and as much as we want, get across the actual philosophy and history and methods of science, because I think even some science teachers, and maybe even many science teachers, I think get some of that wrong, so people have a basic misunderstanding of what science is and what it moves toward. And part of what science is, sort of dovetailing with what Marty said, is getting yourself to a place of rational humility. Because if you know the process of science and you know the history of science, you know it doesn't make sense to lock into any one finding or even any thousand findings too strongly.
Look at Newtonian physics versus Einsteinian physics.
That's exactly what I was thinking. You read my mind. That for, what, centuries, I think? I was going to say decades. We were pretty sure Newton was it. Yeah.
And Newton is still it in the macro world, and in quantum mechanics and quantum physics actually applies, because that was basically my area, and there's a correspondence principle that says quantum mechanics reduces to classical mechanics in the macro world. So, I mean, that which is another thing that says that there's no inconsistency there. And that's where I want to ask both Marty and Brian this, because they're both scientists that do research, and Marty's talked about doing research. I left graduate school about 1987. One of the things that intrigued me is what got me interested in science was the thinking that went on in the history of science. Some of the people, when they didn't have the tools to analyze things like we do right now, I don't know if you guys know about Emil Fischer. He's responsible for molecules having a handedness. You don't need to understand that, but he discovered, he was looking at a bowl of sugar one day and thought he saw different crystalline structures. He actually pulled them out, as the story goes, with tweezers and looked at them under the microscope. Which I just thought was fascinating. Or Linus Pauling, I saw a special years ago where he's describing where he came up with the beta-pleta twisting of one of the proteins or something like that. He discovered that out of boredom. A lot of people don't realize that. He was sick, had nothing to do, and he drew out the molecular structure as they knew it to scale on a piece of paper. And he started looking at it and saw that if he twisted the paper a certain way, that things would line up for the twisting of the pleats. So that leads me to my question, is when I was leaving, computers were just coming in, and one of the things that always that I had kind of a fear of, and that's what I want you guys to respond to as you've watched research over the years, is as we got better tools, we became more able to analyze data, and in some cases that can replace critical, logical thinking in science, can be replaced for technological instrumentation.
Marty, you want to go first on that?
Yeah, so I in the same way that you talked about Newtonian and Einsteinian physics being complementary, I really think that that instrumentation analytics is complementary to ideas. I mean, the truth is science really advances because two things get improved. People's ideas about some aspect of the natural world get better, and the tools that we have to measure mm-hmm. the validity of the ideas gets better. So on the one hand, you have the double helix, incredible discovery. But you also have these very fast gene mapping systems that allow us to figure out very quickly what an individual's gene map looks like and what the human genome looks like, et cetera, et cetera. So the truth is I think they're handmaidens of each other. And for most of science, what's happened is that the ideas are ahead of the tools to measure and validate the ideas. But I think you're right. We're now in a place where we have some analytical tools that actually might be a little bit out front. And that's okay. I think it will all balance itself out. I just think science has always had this yin and yang about what psychologists call dust bowl empiricism versus conceptualization. And really, to me, that's just recognizing the contributions of the tools and of the ideas.
I think a great example of them going hand in hand was Einstein's theories had to be actually validated. I think it was in 1919, 1920. By observation of a an eclipse.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a whole exciting story about that maybe you all know as well or better than I do, but he had to basically run around the globe to find a way in which to empirically validate what he rationally thought was true. It's quite an exciting story, I think.
Yeah, the story and just came out because it was the anniversary of that. I think it was 1919, so... 100th anniversary of that. It's interesting.
And then other parts of Einstein's theory have not been validated until relatively recently because
right.
we haven't had the, like super collider behavior. We had to build super colliders that were able to do things to assess some of the ideas. So Vern, I do understand your worry. And I do think that when we short shrift either one of these two critical pieces of science, science suffers.
Yeah, I was just, my concern was not about, I was just the point that you need to, my father took up scuba diving in the very early days when it became, went out of the commercial world. As he always used to say, good equipment only makes a good diver better, but good equipment can't make a good diver out of a bad diver. And I'm not against the equipment or instrumentation. I think it's all fascinating, but as I think it's easy like a moth to the flame. As we get really leading edge technology, there can be an attraction to forget that it's merely a tool to assist us in the endeavor of science. And you need to keep in mind we're using tools. That was the only point I was trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'll just piggyback on that really quickly, Marty, and then toss it back to you. One of the things, one of the best ways, at least in my opinion, to describe science is the pursuit of validity. And my favorite definition of validity is the best available approximation of the truth. And so as you are all talking, I thought, well, the better our tools are, the more data we have, which means we can better approximate the truth. So I agree with what everyone's saying. I think they go hand in hand, and the tools help us to pursue the best approximation of truth that we can get to at the present moment, given our limitations and our tools.
Yeah, good.
Jack. What do you have to say about that in the business world? Do you have the equivalent to that in the business world?
Well, in the business world, I guess the only equivalent I could see is that competition can make today's truth or today's top dog and best business model can destroy it tomorrow because somebody's going to come out with a better idea. And one difference between science and business is that science, your best available approximation of the truth, once you get there, most of that is it's not going to be totally overturned. Like you said, quantum physics didn't overturn Newtonian physics, but the iPhone did overturn the BlackBerry. And, you know, all kinds of things can come out, and things can recycle. Old ideas become new again. Right. New ideas get stale, and so on. So I guess in business is the most profitable approximation of the truth, if I could just try to come up with something here.
You know, I was thinking, Jack, that as I was playing around with the where they might overlap is that the quote-unquote truth in business is, or at least one way to think about it, is what will people pay for?
Yeah.
And it floats in, and you know, like sometimes they'll pay for a pet rock, and then they'll stop paying for the pet rock, and maybe 20 years later, the people want pet rocks again.
That's exactly right. People always ask me, what's something worth? And what something is worth is only what the next customer is willing to pay at this moment.
And I think that maps on really nicely to the idea of the nature of knowledge to us limited human beings. You know, none of us that I've met are gods, but that the nature of knowledge is that it's ongoing, it's flowing, and just like I mentioned before, if you hold on too tightly to one study or a meta-analysis or a thousand studies, you might get some whiplash when some other study comes along and blows that out of the water. I think it's the same thing in business. You might be selling pet rocks and making millions, but then the next year people get uninterested in pet rocks, and if you're not ready for that, then you're in trouble.
Right, right.
Pet boulders.
You gotta
By the way,
hypothesis,
I pasted
though.
Hair. I pasted hair and sunglasses on rocks years ago for someone that wanted to take off on that and wanted to sell punk rocks. It didn't go anyplace, but it was
cute. Try it now.
The next $1 million idea.
Whatever you can get the stick. Well, you know, we can go another half hour, but I know that we're close to our typical show time, and you all are business busy people. So you want to wrap it up, or you tell me what we need to do. As your host, I give you the option and opportunity. By the way, Jack, as a side note, how was your birthday?
How was my birthday?
Yeah.
Well, it out of the 61 I've had, I'd say it was certainly at least average. And I don't mean that in a bad way. No, I had a nice birthday. I had a nice birthday.
Very good.
I'm actually looking forward to 2 weeks from now because both my kids and their spouses will be here, and we're having a baby shower for my daughter. That's the kind of stuff. We're all old enough to know that sometimes other people's birthdays are more important or feel more important than our own. But
you know,
thanks for asking.
We've all gotten to that phase, yeah.
Pardon? Yeah, it's going to be a girl.
Oh, Jack,
yep, a girl.
You are in for a treat. You are in for a treat. Grandfather, just love. Oh, those little girls are so damn cute.
Oh, I know.
She's going to be spoiled.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then I'll let them deal with the consequences.
My brother's got the same thing that you said you had with your kids. Neither of his have given him any grandchildren. Shame.
So go ahead.
No, go ahead, Marty.
I wasn't going to say. I was just going to say, you know, in high school, when they're in high school, you're sweating bullets about whether they're going to get somebody pregnant. And your whole value system switches about 10 years later.
The nature of knowledge is that it always flows and changes.
Contextual. Exactly.
Well, in the spirit of negotiation and fairness, which is in the quality civility spoke, What I think we should do is end on time, because that's something that I'm really big on. I've asked people to give us a half an hour, an hour and a half, I'm sorry, once per month, and I want to respect their time. So if everybody else is thinks that's reasonable, I think it'd be good to begin the wrap-up portion of the show.
Yeah, go ahead. You start the wrap-up, Brian, and I've said everything I have to say at this particular point.
Okay. Well, for me, just wrapping up, again, just more and more gratitude for this group encouraging me on a monthly basis to think about these things, talk about these things, and I carry you all with me in between shows, because I'm constantly thinking about this show and how what I'm experiencing out there in family, education, and business might relate to what we're talking about, and then how what we're talking about might relate to my clients and students and family members as well. So it's a really nice feedback loop for me, and I'll just continue to express my gratitude for all of you in my life, and really happy that we've been able to take the conversations I've had over the years with all of you and put them in one setting so we can all get to know each other and then shoot them out to whoever wants to listen to them. So really appreciate you all.
I will say ditto, and well said, Brian.
Yep, well said, and I have nothing to add to that. I just feel the same way, and I really appreciate these times together.
Well, with that, folks, we're going to kind of bring this to a close. My name is Vernon Bohr. You've been listening to Journey into Excellence with Jack Malcolm, Brian Higley, and Dr. Marty Haysacker, and we will catch you all next month.